Hello and welcome to Can Queer, home of Canada's queer media. My name is Luke Smith and I'm on my own today, although our show is certainly very busy with lots of voices. Today's show is a little different from other ones. We actually attended the Senate committee hearing, the Justice and Legal Affairs Senate Committee, as they talked about Bill C-16, an act to amend the Criminal Code and Human Rights Act. And what that would do, in essence, which you hear in the episode, would add gender identity and gender expression as a protected ground. Now, in this segment that's about to come up, we will have the Right Honourable Justice Wilson Raybould, the Attorney General and Justice Minister of Canada, joined by her deputy ministers as they take questions from senators at this committee. Now, we've edited it down a little bit to kind of save time. It was a two-hour meeting, so you'll hear the odd swoosh, and that's just where we've cut out the question or pauses, etc., to kind of give you as much content as we could, to let you hear what I heard at this committee. So we'll hand it over, and it'll be back in the studio just after this.
Thank you, Senator, and good morning to all the honourable senators and everybody that is here. I am thankful to be given the opportunity to present to this committee on Bill C-16. And in my remarks today, I will be outlining the broad objectives of the bill, explain the specific amendments that are being proposed within it, and then respond to some questions that have been raised about the bill. And at the close of my remarks, of course, would be very pleased to take questions from the honourable senators present. So Bill C-16, an act to amend the Canadian Human Rights Act and the Criminal Code, is an incredibly important step in protecting the dignity, security, and freedom of trans and gender diverse Canadians. These individuals, like all of us, deserve equal protection under the law so they can make for themselves the lives that they are able and wish to have. The premise of Bill C-16 is that all Canadians should be free to be themselves, without fear of discrimination, hate propaganda, or hate crime. Sadly, this is not yet the experience of many trans people in this country. As you are all aware, trans, gender diverse, and two-spirited persons face elevated levels of violence and risk of violence, including physical and sexual assault and verbal, physical, and sexual harassment. They also face significant obstacles in obtaining and advancing in employment, and not because of a lack of qualification. Yet our human rights protections and criminal law do not explicitly protect this vulnerable group. With this bill, Parliament has the opportunity to affirm in clear language that trans and gender diverse persons are entitled to equal protection from discrimination, hate propaganda, and hate crime, and that all Canadians are entitled to manifest their gender identity and gender expression without fear for their safety. Canada is strengthened by its diversity, and this diversity succeeds best when our laws and institutions promote social inclusion and participation for all. This is fundamentally what this bill is about and supposed to do. To this end, Bill C-16 proposes to make three amendments. First, it would amend the Canadian Human Rights Act to add two prohibited grounds of discrimination: gender identity and gender expression. As a result of this amendment, it would be a prohibited discriminatory practice to disadvantage people because of their gender identity or expression in matters of employment and the provision of goods, services, facilities, and accommodation customarily available to the public. While the Canadian Human Rights Act only applies within a federal jurisdiction, every province and territory has now passed or introduced similar amendments to their provincial human rights legislation to protect trans and gender diverse persons from discrimination. This bill would be the final piece of the puzzle in ensuring full protection for trans and gender diverse persons across the country. Second, this bill also proposes to amend the Criminal Code. It would expand the list of identifiable groups that are protected from hate propaganda by adding gender identity or expression to the list. And finally, it would clarify that hatred on the basis of gender, identity, or expression should be considered as an aggravating factor in sentencing for a criminal offense. This is not the first time that the Senate is studying this issue. In the 41st Parliament, this committee considered Bill C-279, a very similar bill. As mentioned, all provinces and territories have either passed or introduced similar amendments to their own human rights statutes. And in light of this, I believe these amendments are long overdue. This bill would be the final piece of the puzzle in ensuring full protection for trans and gender diverse persons across the country. Now I'd like to turn to the objection that this legislation may introduce many gender identities. I have heard that this bill would introduce 70 plus genders. This is not the case, and I am grateful for the chance to set the record straight. Bill C-16 does not define or legislate a particular list or number of gender identities. The bill is based on the recognition that not all Canadians fit neatly into one or two boxes, male or female, man or woman.
First of all, coming from Newfoundland and Labrador, our Human Rights Act 2010 says gender identity, gender expression, section 9.1. The Nova Scotia Human Rights Act 1989, gender identity, gender expression. Alberta, section 4, gender, gender identity, gender expression. Ontario, 1990, gender identity, gender expression. BC, 1996, gender identity or expression. Northwest Territories, 2002, gender identity. Quebec Charter, gender identity or expression. And finally, PEI, gender identity, 1998. Saskatchewan, 1979, prohibited ground gender identity. Manitoba Human Rights Code, 1987, gender identity. So my question to you is this, Minister. Why has it taken so long for the federal government? And perhaps this is an unfair question for you. I perhaps unwise to be adversely critical of previous administrations. So my supplementary question, I'll put it, it's very short. It's to your deputy minister, legal authority on these issues. Mr. Pentney, we've heard submissions concerning the use of washrooms or change rooms. Could you explain to this committee whether or not that comes under provincial jurisdiction, provincial law, which I've just quoted, going back to 1987, and even in federal buildings, could you comment on the jurisdictional question concerning those matters which have been raised at this committee?
Well, Senator, thank you for the history of the amendments to human rights legislation, and perhaps I can answer the first question. I'm happy to turn it over to the deputy to answer the jurisdictional question. Why has it taken so long? I am fully intent on focusing on the job that I have, our government has, and we as parliamentarians have at hand. If not now, when? And if not us, who? I very much hope that we will be able to move this important piece of legislation through, as I know that the legislatures of New Brunswick and up in the Yukon are doing at this time as well. But it is imperative upon us all, I would respectfully say, that we ensure that we provide protections against discrimination for individuals on the basis of their gender identity and gender expression to complete the circle of history that you have reflected on. I'm happy to turn it over to the deputy to talk about the jurisdictional question.
Thank you, Senator. Maybe just to supplement what the minister said, the history of human rights protection in Canada has been a history of evolution, and over time, protections have been added, and it's taken some time in provinces and the federal government. So the first modern human rights law was adopted in Ontario in 1960, 1961, in recognition that criminal prohibitions hadn't worked. that the state needed to stand with victims and that a commission using an administrative process with a combination of enforcement and educational tools could have an impact. The Canadian Human Rights Act wasn't adopted to cement that into federal jurisdiction until 1976. And in between, different provinces adopted different laws. And it's undeniable, looking at that history, that the adoption of the Canadian Human Rights Act has made a real difference to the lives of Canadians who operate within federal jurisdiction, federal employees, people who use banks, people who have access to airlines. That the adoption of the Act, as coming late as it might have been, has had a real impact in the intervening period. And I think that history is worth remembering.
So how about my question?
In respect of jurisdiction, very simply, Senator, as you know, property and civil rights are generally within the jurisdiction of the exclusive jurisdiction of the provinces. And rules about accessibility, rules about washrooms, generally speaking, are governed by provincial legislation. Access to federal buildings is a more complicated endeavor, and the Canadian Human Rights Act provides that services ought to be equally accessible. And so there would be areas within federal jurisdiction. Indeed, I would note that the building, the washroom downstairs, would not be regulated, for example. The washrooms in this building would not be regulated by provincial jurisdiction, but the vast, vast majority of those situations would be subject to provincial jurisdiction.
I do want to correct two things, Minister, or one maybe, and then just one comment very quickly. There are significant differences between Bill C-16 and 279. They are not the same bill at all. And secondly, gender expression is not an identifiable group. Gender identity may be, gender expression is not. You can comment on that at the end if you wish. When we need gender identity and gender expression, or when we add it to the Canadian Human Rights Act, we are leaving definitions, parameters, and guidelines up to the Canadian Human Rights Commission to interpret. That's a quote. Now, Minister, do you agree with that policy? And I'll just finish the question, Chair. If an individual, an intellectual dissenter perhaps, does not subscribe to the theory of an infinite gender spectrum, and what if that person does not believe that there are more than two genders, and this is simply talking about being more than two genders, not a person wanting to be the other gender, for personal, scientific, or faith-based reasons, do you believe they should have to refer to a person by a personal pronoun, and should failure to do so constitute discrimination?
Well, thank you, Senator Platt, for those questions. I'll tackle them from the last to the first. As I stated in my remarks, one can't compel somebody to refer to somebody by way of a pronoun or otherwise. There's nothing within Bill C-16 that would compel somebody to have to call somebody by the pronoun he or she or otherwise. In terms of definitions, thank you for reading that excerpt. We specifically haven't defined gender identity or expression within Bill C-16. Having said that, as you note, or was noted in that quote, the Canadian Human Rights Commission, as well as other commissions across the country, have done substantive work in terms of engaging with the trans community and providing documents that further go into putting parameters around what a definition of gender identity or expression would be, as there are dozens, if not hundreds, of case law that speak to and further define the gender identity or expression. And certainly with respect to somebody's deeply held personal beliefs about their identity, this must be in a case where discrimination is alleged, dealt with on a case-by-case basis. And I would say in terms of gender identity and gender expression, as I said in my comments, gender identity is about how somebody seeks to identify themselves by their personal beliefs. That may be male or female, it may be both, it may be neither, and it recognizes the gender spectrum. In terms of gender expression, and if gender expression was, and this was a debate that has had happened over the years, gender expression is equally as important to be contained within Bill C-16 as gender expression is the manifestation or the outward expression of an individual, what that individual chooses to wear in a workplace. And I firmly believe it's incumbent upon us as lawmakers to ensure that we provide for protections of individuals in terms of their gender expression. So as to protect those individuals in a workplace or any other federally regulated place so that they can ensure that they can express themselves in a way that's appropriate for them.
Thank you, Chair.
And the Deputy wants to add something.
I'm sorry, just very quickly. I think I would urge the committee to look at what is actually being said and that might fall within the rubric of expressions of hate. Senator Dupuy and I serve with the Commission, Canadian Human Rights Commission, and saw some of this up close. It's important to look at the words that might conceivably be caught with the criminal prohibition. They're calls to violence, and we know that violence is actually happening, that words have meaning. And so I would encourage you in looking at the freedom of expression argument to also look at the harder edge of this, which is some of what's being said on the internet, some of which is otherwise being communicated because it is ugly. And if it was ever to fall within willfully, intentionally promoting hatred subject to a prosecution with the Attorney General's consent, it would be on such the extreme end of incitement to violence that I would just suggest it's a useful reminder, and I would encourage the Senate to try to explore the harder edge of that. And I think we would respectfully disagree with the gal's position because the criminal prohibition focuses on the intention of the speaker. And to the extent the intention of the speaker is that violence or hatred should be subjected to people because they dress differently, wear earrings, have other forms of what would be seen by some to be non-traditional gender expression, and the expression is so violent and so extreme that it might fall within the prohibition, we would expect a court to treat that very seriously, as they should, to interpret it very narrowly and to put the crown to a very high standard of proof, all of which is appropriate. It would be in that context that the constitutional defense. This wouldn't happen in the air. This would happen in the context of a real case. And one would think police wouldn't charge if there was doubt about whether or not it was sufficiently extreme or whether or not it was sufficiently directed to the subset of the community that we think it's likely to be directed to, or that the Crown wouldn't prosecute, or that the judge wouldn't convict. So understand, again, in the air in a general way, in an academic kind of way, perhaps, that debate about is the language precise enough. It will be in the application of the language, we believe, that the constitutional decisions will be made. And if the case is clear enough that violence was to be incited, that there was a call to violence, let's go out to a park and beat up ... that as long as the language was clear enough that we think it would withstand constitutional scrutiny. I would note that there's a variety of religious expressions, that people choose to live their religion and express it publicly in very different ways. And yet we've recognized that expressions of hatred against particular religious groups, notwithstanding the diversity of ways in which people live with their religion, has been found to be constitutional. And I would think that the same thing would happen here. Again, in an appropriate case.
The question, Senator, and without question, we, upon royal assent of C-16, we have work to do. And in terms of Passport Canada, in terms of the work that's occurring within individual ministries to recognize gender identity and gender expression, as I understand it and preparing today, the Prime Minister and our government working with Passport Canada is looking at a third gender designation. That work is continuing. Likewise, work is continuing within other departments to see how we can update policies and the application of policies. And in doing so, we are committed to ensuring that we engage with the trans community to get their feedback. And operationalizing C-16 is something that will unfold necessarily so. And again, we do have work to do to recognize that simply ticking a box of male or female doesn't accord with the intent of what's in Bill C-16. So,
core to the evolution of human rights law in Canada, our understanding of equality has been an evolution from things which are seen as innate to other things, which were core to a personal identity, core to their vision of themselves, and should be changed not by virtue of employer or service provider or state coercion, but by virtue of their choice. So we said a long time ago as a society that employers shouldn't fire women because they choose to get married, and that's what was happening. Not men, women. They said they shouldn't fire women because they, quote, choose to become pregnant. That they shouldn't fire or refuse to hire someone because they've chosen to express their religion or not to express their religion. And to the extent that those things all can change in one's life as one matures and evolves, what we've said is that we as a society believe those are protected spaces. The choice should be the individuals, not the states, not the employers, not the service providers. That we should be neutral to that and let people live their lives as they choose and wish to be. That's what this law would say if it was adopted by Parliament.
Final question, Senator Sinclair.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Minister, for being here. And since we don't have any difficulty understanding what freedom of expression means, I commend you for not trying to put a definition on the word expression in this bill, because we shouldn't have to define a common sense word.
I am speaking to you today as a parent, a scholar, and as an advocate. Florence was 4 years old when we realized that her gender expression was not a phase, as some people kept telling us, but rather something more central to her identity. Fortunately for us, we had the advantage of tremendous resources at our disposal. Good incomes that allowed us to move to an expensive neighborhood so that my daughter could get access to an alternative school setting. Academic skills and connections that could be mobilized to generate new research and forms of support. A strongly supportive faith community, Montreal's Christchurch Cathedral, and the privilege of whiteness. Indeed, although we experience some very real challenges, these challenges cannot compare to those struggling at the margins of poverty and or those facing the combined oppressions of transphobia and racism. Florence is just one of hundreds of Canadian children who are now living openly in accordance with their felt sense of gender. Unlike Florence, however, many transgender young people have grave difficulty accessing food, education, health care, and shelter. Prior to coming to terms with Florence's gender nonconformity, I had never before considered the possibility that a child could be transgender. And this is despite the fact that I taught gender and politics at the graduate level at Concordia University. I thus understand why, for some, the idea of transgender and gender nonconforming children may seem perplexing. Transgender children are children whose gender identity does not align with the gender that they were assigned at birth. Although many transgender children know themselves to be a girl or boy, some are more fluid in their presentation and understanding of self. Research involving genetics, neuroanatomy, and studies of intersex diversity provide solid evidence that the biological basis of gender identity is strong. It is part of our very personal, profound, and intimate knowledge of ourselves. What we know now is that poor parenting is not a determining factor of transgender identities. Overall, research suggests that parenting connectedness is key for the well-being of trans youth. Findings the Canadian Association of Social Workers and the Canadian Psychological Association have now incorporated into their guidelines for practitioners. The Senate, I would like to argue before you today, should pass Bill 16, C-16, unamended for three major reasons: affirmation, access, and autonomy. As a parent, I want my child to be seen as who she fully is. I want her to have the dignity that should be afforded to all people who reside in Canada. While I recognize that passing Bill C-16 does not guarantee that my child will be respected, I do know that law has a powerful role to play in changing public consciousness. As senators, you have an opportunity to bend the arc of history. At this moment of rising anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, racism, sexism, and transphobia, you can offer not just my kid, but all kids in Canada a chance to expand their understanding of and appreciation for the diversity of human experience. I want Canadian children, regardless of their gender identity, to have full and safe access to all public institutions and public space. Bill C-16, if passed as is, can help ensure that gender-diverse children and youth have affirming access to public space, including bathrooms, social services, and shelters. Not all trans children and youth have the support of their caregivers. In fact, the majority do not. Despite this, most shelters are unprepared for transgender youth and continue to discriminate against them. Trans youth, especially young trans women of color, are among the most discriminated against groups of people in the shelter system. Trans people continually experience transphobic violence and erasure in shelters and housing programs across this country. Like so many of the challenges faced by transgender people in Canada, access to safe and affirming shelter cannot be fixed by the passage of Bill C-16 alone. But passage of Bill C-16 is an important step in the effort to provide trans youth with much needed support. Most importantly, the passage of Bill C-16 will signal to agencies, shelters, and caregivers that all children and youth have the right to be affirmed, protected, and cherished. 2 years ago, Florence and I traveled to Ottawa to participate in a protest against amendments that had been introduced by this committee to Bill C-279. When critics argue that Bill C-16 is being rammed through without due process, I want you to remember that 2 years in the life of a child is the equivalent to 10.
I will have to do. We're moving on to Ms. Botvin.
Please let Bill C-16 come to a vote. Thank you.
I've been asked to come forward and tell my family's story. You must first know that by doing so, I put myself and my family at great risk. Many others have struggled to find ways that they can safely speak up on this issue, and some have had to keep quiet. After last telling our story publicly, we were bombarded with a number of letters and emails stating that we were sick and should be shot and burned. The only way I can think of truly expressing the fear we felt when we realized that our child was transgender is to share parts of the Facebook post that I posted to family and friends to come out. It was posted in August of 2013. When Warner was 2 years old, we were lying in bed one night. We were reading a story, and Warner said to me, "Mommy, I think God made a mistake." I asked what he meant, and he said, "I'm really a little girl." Warner was able to verbalize what we were already noticing in his daily life, but had dismissed as a phase. Since then, it has progressed. Warner insists he is a little girl on the inside. Now I know what some of you are thinking. He is six. Or he was six at the time, how could he possibly even know that? I tell you, I thought the exact same thing. But the Warner I see today, who sits behind me, is very obviously a little girl, on the inside and out. This is not a phase. It will not go away. Please keep in mind this is a child. Please continue to look at Warner with love. God made him this way, and he has certainly opened our minds up. Warner is already being made fun of and already feels a lot of anxiety with regards to this. He has told us that he will kill himself if we insisted on cutting his hair and forcing him to look like a boy for school. My heart breaks every time I try to think about all this. I have a very hard time openly discussing this, and even after this post, I'm not sure if I'll be able to. The big decision here was to share this and to open up, or to continue and try and downplay it and hide it. But Warner is no longer giving us that option. In the past, I have avoided posting pictures of Warner when he was dressed as a little girl, out of fear. I will no longer hide my child. Elmer and I are struggling with this, and it is a very emotional issue. Take it for this, what this post is meant for, to help us all understand people like Warner and know that they have no choice. He will suffer tremendously because of this, and already has. Our society has come a long way, but not quite far enough for children like Warner. He is not sick, nor is he just confused. Warner is, in fact, a little girl, aside from his boy parts. Again, I ask that you remember that in Warner's future, many people in this world will reject him, make fun of him, hurt him, and fear him. As a result, no matter what I choose as a parent, he will suffer, as many people like him have and do. I have faith in the people in our lives and want and hope that even those with religious views about this kind of stuff understand that if I could change this, I would. The big guy upstairs has reasons for everything, and we are all equally deserving of love and respect. All four of my children were identified as male at birth by doctors. However, for one of my twins, it was much more complicated than a simple glance at his genitals. Warner has been exhibiting female mannerisms and preferences at as early as the age of three. We tried to encourage her to accept her male identity. Our first thoughts were that it was just a phase. We had even considered that she may be homosexual. And we were hopeful if that was the case, we could push it off until she reached puberty. Over the next few years, she kept saying that she was actually a girl. We had numerous discussions with our doctor, and we began researching children with behavior and thoughts like hers. I had no idea that children could even be transgender until I came across it in a Google search. Having Catholic and conservative beliefs, we initially dismissed the notion that one of our children could possibly be transgender. We read everything we could to try and understand, and meanwhile, we allowed Warner to wear dresses and female clothing in private. The fear of social rejection and inevitable bullying kept us hiding this secret for 6 years from the closest family and friends. By the age of six, we were seeing an increase in Warner's distress with being labeled as a boy. She was sad and very uncomfortable in her own skin. We were worried for her. We sought medical help and consulted our priest. I will be honest, at that point, I wanted nothing more than for someone to fix my son. I soon understood that no one could give me the son I thought I gave birth to, because Warner was never really my son at all. Through medical guidance, reading research, and with love and faith, we were able to see that supporting Warner to be herself gave her the best chance of growing up healthy and happy. We agreed to let her do social transition. This was the hardest decision of my life, the results of which were evident immediately. This uncomfortable and sad little boy became this beautiful, happy, outgoing little girl almost overnight. We quickly became aware of all the negativity families like ours face. Many families live in constant fear and in hiding and don't even fathom the idea of letting their children live freely and openly. We weighed our options, pack up and start over somewhere else, or come out and deal with the consequences. To this day, I have many family and friends that will not speak to me and do not see my children.
Please come to a conclusion.
I will just skip ahead then. Warner has already been bullied to the extent that no individual should have to endure. I can give you an example of the type of abuse trans people face.
No.
Warner has been assaulted.
I'm sorry. You were all given a 5-minute limit. We've all...
that everybody gets a chance to be who and what they are. I just know if I have to pee, I'm going to pee. I don't care where it's going to be.
Hello and welcome back to Can Queer, home of Canada's Queer Media. My name is Luke Smith, and we are actually covering the Legal and Constitutional Affairs Committee. Now, in this next segment, and we just hear them introduce themselves, is Brenda Cosman, Director of the Bonham Centre for Sexual Diversity Studies at the University of Toronto, Kimberly Manning, Principal for the Simone de Beauvoir Institute and Associate Professor at Concordia, and Melissa Potvin, a parent and advocate and community leader. And we'll hear them and speak more in their own words. Just now you heard Ray Spoons, I hear them calling, and back to the committee.
As the minister outlined, Bill C-16 basically does three things. It adds gender identity and expression to the Canadian Human Rights Code, to the hate speech provisions of the Criminal Code, and the hate crimes provisions of the Criminal Code. My submission today is that none of these reforms will result in a violation of freedom of expression as guaranteed by the Charter of Rights. Let's start with the easiest one first, sentencing for hate crimes in Section 7182A1 of the Criminal Code. This provision allows evidence that an offense motivated by bias, prejudice, or hatred can be taken into account in sentencing. Race, national and ethnic origin, language, color, religion, sex, age, mental or physical disability, and sexual orientation are already included. Now, evidence of hatred on the basis of gender identity and gender expression can also be taken into account. It's important to emphasize here that Section 718 does not create a new offense. It simply means that an existing offense in the Criminal Code, like murder or aggravated sexual assault, if it is motivated by hatred, can be given an increased sentence. There's absolutely no impact here on freedom of expression or gender pronouns by adding gender identity and gender expression. The hate speech laws. These are actually three laws. There is three provisions, advocating genocide, public incitement of hatred, and the willful promotion of hatred. Do these provisions mandate pronoun usage or criminalize pronoun misuse? Not even close. It is absolutely not advocating genocide. Public incitement of hatred, well, that has a very, very high threshold as imposed by the court. It requires that there be a likelihood of the breach of the peace that will result in violence and personal violence. The misuse of pronouns, again, doesn't come close. The willful promotion of hatred. Well, hate speech laws also have a very high threshold. As the minister mentioned several times this morning, the Supreme Court of Canada has repeatedly defined hate speech as only including the most extreme forms of speech. And I quote, extreme manifestations of detestation or vilification, not dislike, disdain, or offense. Further, again, as the minister mentioned, hate speech criminal charges cannot be laid without the approval of the Attorney General. Pronoun misusage, without more, simply could not give rise to a charge of hate speech, let alone a conviction. Now, also as the minister stated, while talking about hate speech laws more generally, the Supreme Court of Canada has consistently upheld the constitutionality of these laws, both criminally and within human rights codes. From Keegstraw in 1990 to a unanimous court in Watcott in 2011, the Supreme Court of Canada has said that any restriction that these laws place on freedom of expression is a reasonable limit within the meaning of Section 1. Noting that the Ontario Human Rights Commission does not require any particular gender-neutral pronoun. They suggest the use of the word they, or, if you are not comfortable with that, simply use a person's chosen name. There is a requirement that people not be intentionally misgendered. It is not a right to a particular gender-neutral pronoun. And I believe that it does not even, in fact, mandate the use of gender-neutral pronouns. If people oppose that, they can simply abide by the law by using a person's name. It requires that we don't use the wrong name, and if you don't like the right one, then just use a person's name.
I'm trying to wrap my head around the concept of enshrining rights based on an individual's identity. So I think my question will be for Ms. Manning and or Ms. Potman. Do you believe that people can identify as another race, another age, as transabled? Do you believe that these individuals are as valid as those identifying another gender? I met with a biologically male adult who identifies as a six-year-old girl. Do you believe this individual's feelings of being a female are more legitimate than his feelings as being a child? And lastly, do you believe that any of these groups should have special protection under the law?
Brenda, you said for either.
Listen, Ms. Cosman, if you want to answer, that's fine.
Uh, So I don't think that we are here today to discuss a whole series of identities. I think that we are here today to discuss a bill that specifically
Could
protects gender identity and gender expression. I believe that Bill C-16 is a fundamentally important bill to address the unique vulnerabilities and disadvantages that trans and gender diverse Canadians have experienced historically and still today. And I don't think that the other examples that you are giving are ones that are in any way on the public policy table.
Unfortunately, we have great time limits, and so if you would provide your full speech to the clerk, we will certainly read it. Because of time limits, I can ask one question. And so, Ms. Crossman and Ms. Manning, my question to both of you is, as you have, I think, been in the room and we've had the issue of equal rights under 15 and freedom of expression. And when those two are in competition, how do we deal with that?
Well, the idea that there is a competition here in some way, shape, or form, to me, it just does not compute. What we're talking about here is a basic recognition of dignity and making sure that our law now is updated so that fundamental facets of human diversity are respected and protected within Canadian law. To me, nobody is losing out. And as was just made very, very clear by Professor Kossmann, the chances of people somehow having their speech abrogated are zero to none.
It seems to me that this is a place where giving rights to one group is not actually taking away the rights from any other group. Mm-hmm. This is a place where extending rights to one group is simply about extending rights to that group. I don't see this. I do think that there are ways where equality rights and freedom of expression rights do occasionally come into conflict. I don't see that gender identity and gender expression actually coming into conflict with sex.
Can I just add on to that too? Because I know that there have been some questions being raised in this body about whether, and I'm going to put it right here on the table, you know, whether women's rights are going to be undermined by this legislation. And I'd like to speak to that directly by saying, as I'm currently the director of one of the oldest women's studies programs in the country, I'm a very strong feminist. I was in Beijing in 1995, so I've been around a long time in feminist circles and work. And I have to say that passing Bill C-16 is one of the most feminist pieces of legislation that we can pass at this moment in time. As far as I am concerned, supporting and affirming the rights of trans people, particularly transgender women, right, who are targets for misogynic kind of attacks, is really, really critical at this moment in history. So I should also say transgender women of color, especially. So I would just like to note that as a very, very long-term feminist, I mean, my father can correct me on this, but I think I was probably 9 years old when I first identified as a feminist. For me, this is the most pro-feminist thing that we can do at this moment in history.
I have a question of either Professor Kossmann or Ms. Manning. What percentage of the Canadian population is transgendered? Mm-hmm. Has this number changed significantly over time? And do you project that this number will change with the passing of this law? And if so, why?
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. That's a wonderful question. So we don't have good statistics yet, and I think hopefully in the next few years, with changes with the long-form census, we're going to have much better data within the next few years. But I can tell you, with data out of New Zealand, with respect to transgender youth in particular, right now about 1.6% of trans youth are out in New Zealand, at sort of as young people, as teenagers. What we're seeing already before the passage of this bill are huge increases of young people coming to clinics across the country. And when I say huge increases, I mean increases by 400 and 500% between 2009 and 2015. Okay? So the number of young people who are going to be affected, whose lives are going to be improved by this passage of this bill, we cannot underestimate that number. It's hard to put any tabulation on at this point, but I can tell you that these young people are coming out in increasing numbers, and they need us standing behind them. Thank you very much. I really appreciate this question. There is a tremendous need for public education at this point in time. And in fact, that's one of the major reasons that I'm here today, because I feel like with the passage of Bill C-16, we have an opportunity to present to all Canadians to understand much more deeply how necessary it is that we recognize the rights and well-being of transgender and gender diverse people in this country. The need is huge, and it's going to require a lot more than parents like ourselves and the many other parents we know who have been coming out and doing media work, because that's been the main form of communication that we've had available to us, to let other parents know that it's okay to affirm your child, to let other school boards know that it's okay and in fact it's necessary to create safe spaces for all of the children in their schools. So I'm hoping that as we move forward, this is only the first step. But in fact, there is so much more work to do, and particularly for those who are not just fighting transphobia, but are also marginalized by poverty and racism and so many other forms of oppression as well.
I also think that the question about is gender expression too vague, and might it be struck down because it's constitutionally too vague, we can't decide whether it's too vague until the courts have had an opportunity to actually define those terms, much like it is over time evolved definitions for all the other terms of prohibited discrimination.
So absolutely. And what we know, I mean, there have been a number of surveys now. The largest was a 2015 study that came out of UBC. I've quoted it and cited it in my brief, where the violence and the threats of violence that transgender young people experience in schools in particular is astronomically high. Well over, I think, 60%, and for some it's a daily occurrence, right? So we're not talking something, you know, that occasionally, you know, somebody gets asked a rough question. No, we're talking for many people, this is a daily lived experience, and therefore it is no wonder that many trans young people are facing such high rates of health issues, of suicide, and as I was discussing earlier, of homelessness as well. So first it's parent acceptance and support, but then the second place are the schools. And the schools, I'm sorry, but are failing us miserably at this point in time.
Can I just say something?
Please.
My daughter, when she came out, it was a very difficult thing to conquer. We live in rural Ottawa in a Catholic community, and our school is Catholic as well. Within months of coming out and living as her true self, she was attacked by a group of other children that were double her age, six or seven of them, who actually pinned her down to the ground, trying to figure out what her gender was by removing her clothing and trying to see what her genitalia were. This is not rare. This is a common occurrence for these children. It's not an exceptional case. This happens every day. I could give you hundreds of examples I've heard firsthand or been involved with for these kids. And the schools aren't equipped to deal with it because there are no policies or, you know, laws in place. They don't know what to do. So
the day after this bill is passed, will this mean to parents like you, Melissa Potvin and Kimberly Manning, and to your children and to your family, how will this change your lives for the better? Florence and Warner.
Well, we live every day in fear for our daughter, for her future. We are terrified of what she faces, the discrimination, the harassment, the judgment. Having this bill in place, we know will not solve every problem, but at least sends a message to Canadians that it is unacceptable to discriminate against individuals based on their gender identity and gender expression. And for us, I mean, this is absolutely key to our children's future. We're fighting for our children's lives. It's not just some bill to us. For us, it's our children's lives and their future.
The last time this came through this committee, the committee slapped on an exemption for federal protected spaces. And I have to say, I would like to ask that you all remember when you're considering moving forward with this bill that 40% of transgender young people feel unsafe in their school washrooms today. So when you're thinking about protecting vulnerable children and youth, I want you to think about transgender kids and what they are suffering, not in some kind of hypothetical state down the line, but right now at this very moment that I'm speaking.
The Ontario definition of gender identity, as well as Bill C-279, states that, and I quote, sex is assigned at birth. Do you believe sex is assigned at birth? Ms. Potman talked about her son having come to her at six, I believe, and said, I think God made a mistake. So do you believe, Ms. Kosman or any of the others, that sex is assigned at birth?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, the Ontario definition of gender identity says sex is assigned at birth. We have heard the sponsor of this bill in his speeches a number of times say the sex assigned at birth. Now, I didn't take science beyond high school, but my understanding of biological sex that was determined by anatomy and chromosomes, and it wasn't assigned at birth. So people are saying I was assigned the wrong sex at birth.
I can speak to that. Thank you. So what we're talking about is when a doctor or midwife looks at a child's genitals and says, oh, I see a penis, or oh, I see a vulva. And on the basis of that, they make a decision of what they think the sex of the child is. Now, in this bill, what we're enshrining into law is the protection of gender identity and gender expression. You just spoke of chromosomal, genetic, you know, there are all kinds of different basis for one's constitution as a sex, as a biological experience. But that is not necessarily the same as one's gender identity. And so that's what we're talking about. We're talking about when a physician or a midwife looks at a child's genitals and says, oh, that's what we have here. And then what we find out later is sometimes that's not actually the case.
One can't help but be absolutely horrified by the story you told. And I want to share my disgust and dismay that this happens in Canadian schools in particular. I want to understand the material impact of C-16 on that particular kind of context, because this is federal law, schools are provincial. I want to understand how this will play out.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'll speak to that. Very pleased that so many of the provinces have been moving ahead of this house to ensure that, or try to make sure that schools are beginning to comply and create safe spaces for all children and young people. However, and what I really want to stress here today, is that the passage of this law, even though it does not technically affect ministries of education, it in a sense sends a clear signal to all Canadians and all jurisdictions that it is absolutely unacceptable to discriminate against transgender and gender diverse Canadians and all transgender and gender diverse peoples living in Canada. So I just want to be very, very clear that this body has an incredible responsibility to send a message to everybody else who is in Canada today about the importance of the passage and the protection of these rights. And I think that's going to be the biggest impact of this work moving forward. Yeah, thank you.
There will be a ripple effect, I think.
Okay. Yeah.
Once this bill is passed, it will eventually, it'll give them the kick in the pants they need on other levels to recognize the need for protection for these children and adults.
We are at a moment in history where we're seeing south of the border legislation being introduced and in some cases passed, which is transphobic in the extreme. And we're seeing this with the bathroom bills that are being introduced right now. So I would argue that right now in history, Canada has an important responsibility to signal that we are not going to go down that road, and that we are, in effect, going to show what it means to protect all of the people who reside within our borders. So I think that we can play a real leadership role on this file internationally.
Can I just say something for you?
Please.
I can speak to experience with this. Most recently, we were approached by the BBC network. And what they are saying is the UK is looking to Canada to see what we are doing
because we have seen such an influx and we have started the health care for children like this, they are actually looking to us to be the example. We recently took part in a documentary to express this, and the idea was to show UK what we're doing. So we have a chance to be real leaders in the international level right now.
So the United States is not the place to look to right now for the protection of most things. There are a host of countries that have different kinds of protections for trans individuals, some places where one might not expect them. There was a recent decision of the Indian Supreme Court that actually extended protections to trans citizens. New Zealand has some very interesting developments afoot. The Israeli Supreme Court has made a decision. It's not the Supreme Court, it's one of the lower courts on trans rights. So this is a thing that is emerging in a kind of patchwork around the world right now, much the way that same-sex marriage evolved in a patchwork where Canada was among the front runners, where Canada was a global leader. We're not alone in doing this, but it remains a bit of a patchwork, and we certainly can provide leadership, but we aren't alone.
We're at a moment where we are seeing the evolution of law, we're seeing the evolution of our society. What we do know is the lived experiences that I have done my very best to document in my brief. And it's pretty horrifying. I think it makes for pretty horrifying reading material. This is real. This is happening right now, and it's happening across the country. The arguments that I've heard in opposition to Bill C-16 or, you know, wanting to propose amendments or changes, et cetera, are based, as far as I'm concerned, on hypotheticals and what ifs. We have a very strong court system. We have a very strong and astute and well-researched bill that has been presented before you. To me, it's a no-brainer. And if I may, I would just like to close with the words of my daughter, Florence, who, when we were discussing our preparation for coming here today, said to me, "Look, Mom, it's just respectful that we pass this bill."
And sadly, that is all we have time for this week. Join us next week when we cover Eurovision, and there's been more drama and more, Eurovision than ever before. Join us next week. That's all for now. Thank you.